Welcome to Goodfellow Podcasts. This episode is kindly supported by the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners, the Auckland faculty. I'm Dr. Louise Kugler, and I'm delighted to welcome back to the podcast Dr. Helen Keneally. Today we are discussing how to thrive in the golden years. Helen is a geriatrician and general physician working at Counties Manukau Health in Auckland. She also works privately at Green Lane Medical Specialists. She is the chair of the National Medication Optimisation Group for the Somerset Villages. Helen has completed the Monash short course in perioperative medicine. She sees a wide range of conditions and performs house visits, capacity assessments, and legal reports for her clients and the court. Kia ora, Helen, and welcome back to the podcast. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Louise.
So we're discussing thriving in the golden years. So our patients must remain socially connected, physically active, and cognitively stimulated. I wonder if we can chat about what factors contribute to lower life expectancy in certain groups. And do we know anything about Maori and Pacifica populations specifically?
So we know that as time has ticked on, that life expectancy has increased, both for a Pākehā and Māori. However, Māori and Pacific life expectancy has still not caught up. While their life expectancy has increased, they will still have shorter lifespans on average than Pākehā, which is really important to acknowledge. So this gap is still actually quite wide. If we take some numbers I got, they're actually quite old, for 2013. I think it was 77 would be the average life expectancy for a Māori wahine and 73 for a Māori man, compared to 84 for women and then 80 for non-Māori men. So there is still quite a gap there. And obviously from a public health perspective, there's lots of work to do to close that gap. We, all of us, really want to aim to have as much of our older life disability free, I think it's fair to say, wouldn't we? We don't want to have too much functional limitations. So while we're happy to see life expectancy increasing, I think it's really about the quality of life that we're focusing on here, right? So nobody wants to have a stroke in their 60s and then still have 30 years to live with bad disability. So that's what we want to be aiming for, is disability-free years at a maximum. I think it's interesting that at a National Public Health Service level, 65 is still the sort of magic number with the Ministry of Health. When you're 65, you'll come under geriatric services. And we're seeing more and more patients in that age group of sort of 65 to say 75. If you just think that's ridiculous, they don't feel like they're geriatric. They don't feel like they're old. So we have really seen a shift already, but that cutoff hasn't changed at a Ministry of Health level. Of course, it's when people get their superannuation as well. But we do actually see Māori or Pacific patients from when they're aged 55. And that is to acknowledge this gap in life expectancy and that Māori and Pacifica develop conditions typically associated with older age, much younger than their Pākehā counterparts. We know that there are a lot of factors that contribute to this. So smoking, being male, of course, they have a lower life expectancy than females across the board. Low education levels, obesity. And of course, we'd expect issues such as low socioeconomic status and alcohol use would also contribute to some of these issues.
So to thrive both physically, cognitively and socially, Helen, it's essential that our patients can do the things that they need to do, such as hearing, being able to eat and being able to see. So can you provide some insights and advice on how to do this?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's really important that we maximise all of our senses, right? What you've kind of hit on is a number of our senses. And if we go through them, so when you think about hearing, of course, it's quite hard to access those sorts of things in the public health system, isn't it? But if you go onto your private audiology company, they'll often provide, you know, free, in inverted commas, hearing tests, and then they'll be able to advise you whether there is any sort of hearing aid that might assist with impaired hearing. So there is the ability, therefore, to have wider access for hearing tests in that private sector, is my understanding. I must admit, when it comes to things like hearing aids, though, I'm often really surprised how many patients have these really expensive hearing aids at home that they're not even using. And I think patients will often say to me that they regret having got, you know, the smaller hearing aid or the latest technology hearing aid or something like that without really taking into account how compatible it would be as they age with things like older eyes and arthritic hands, so that they actually then aren't able to change the batteries themselves, turn the devices on and off themselves, or even perhaps insert them correctly into the ears. So there's a lot of factors that need to be taken into account when it comes to something like hearing. And I'm always a big advocate that anybody, including myself, that when you go to an important appointment like an audiology assessment to talk about hearing aids, it's really good to have someone else there with you, right? To have a look at all these options with you and to assess the different pros and cons of them. I also think that, as I understand it, not being an audiologist, there's actually often quite a lot of time and effort that needs to go into setting up the hearing aids, to allowing some reviews for adjustment, for example, over time, to make sure that they are optimised for each individual patient. And I sort of get the sense that obviously a lot of older people perhaps weren't prepared for that level of time investment, or the amount of times they'd have to drive back and forth, the amount of appointments that they'd need, and that often that sort of might fall away. Or, for example, some health event comes into play in the middle of it all, and then, you know, they don't actually get all those adjustments done. So I feel like there's a lot of people out there who perhaps don't benefit from their hearing aids as much as possible. In the inpatient setting, we have hearing amplifiers that we can use. So they literally look like old style headphones, and then they come with an amplifier so you can turn up the sound. They're actually surprisingly effective. So I would highly recommend, as health professionals, that we might consider purchasing them, for example, for your practice if you don't have any. And it is the sort of thing that I guess you could call them a poor man's hearing aid if patients wanted to try that without such a heavy investment into hearing aids. I think we as health professionals, as well as members of the public, need to be really aware of lip reading, for example, and that's been really problematic with the pandemic with all the mask wearing. I think it's important to check in with older people. Am I talking too fast for you, which is something that I'm bad at doing? Am I talking loud enough for you, or too loud? Sometimes they feel like you're shouting at them. We think we're being helpful by raising our voice, but sometimes actually that's not helpful. And how clear is our speech? I think actually people forget that if you can't hear properly, you might still be able to write. So we were having real difficulty actually with a Cantonese patient, for example. And well, we said, well, what if she writes the characters down with the interpreter? And bang, we were able to have really good, although very slow, conversation with her with writing. So always try and remember other ways that you can access patients, not just with hearing. Because poor hearing really impacts on how they socialise and also, of course, how they can interact with health professionals. And then the next one you mentioned was eating. So obviously crucial to eating is our teeth and our swallowing. And as we all know, dentistry isn't funded in this country, but it is really important that our older people are seeing a dentist or a dental hygienist regularly. The problem is cost, right? It's really prohibitive, and most people find it really expensive, and that's why it tends to fall off. Dentures are also really expensive, and of course, if you lose weight, they might not fit well. So there's a lot of things to bear in mind with, for example, dentures, to make sure that they're also optimised for patients. And I want to put a plug in when you're prescribing IV zoledronic acid. It's part of my normal practice as a specialist just to inquire about people's dental health and try to encourage a dental review if possible prior to administration. The idea being that if there are any dental issues that are uncovered in that review, then they can be addressed prior to the infusion. And thinking about swallowing, I was recently at a conference and went to some very interesting talks about sarcopenic dysphagia, which isn't something I've heard talked about in this country before. So the impact that sarcopenia has upon swallowing and speech, and talking to patients about issues like dry mouth, because it's surprisingly common, and we could assist them with some advice around optimising keeping their mouth more dry. And the other sense you mentioned was eye health, which of course is really important. And again, a lot of that falls to the private sector, inverted commas, so that people could have regular reviews, for example, with an optometrist, perhaps yearly or two yearly, and the optometrist would be able to advise them on that. Those reviews, it's not just about checking, you know, for glasses and long and short vision, but also checking for things like glaucoma, which is really important. Large organisations, I understand, for example, Specsavers offer a Supergold card holder discount. So that can really help with the offset of cost. And again, always ask about dry eyes because these things do get common as people age. So again, we can reassure patients that there are drops that they can try rather than just putting up with it. And for people that don't know the University of Auckland, for the Auckland-based people, they run both optometry and audiology clinics, which are open to the public. And they are markedly reduced in terms of their cost because the patient will see a student under close supervision of a trained optometrist or audiologist. So it's kind of a feel-good thing. The patient gets a service for cheaper while helping with the learning of future professionals. And they do have free parking underneath the building. So that's an option for some patients too.
Fantastic. Thank you, Helen. So we know being physically active is important across the lifespan, but also in the golden years. So what are the recommendations for exercise for our older adults?
So I think first of all, we want to encourage our older patients that any exercise and movement is better than nothing. That's got to be the first message that we get across. Tai Chi is actually well regarded for both falls prevention, and there's some evidence growing that perhaps helps with cognitive protection. So I kind of think if you're going to do one activity, that's probably one to look at doing. I'm a big fan of trying to get patients just walking. And that walking, you know, it's free, it's easily accessible. And all the walking that you do adds up. So even if you just do 10 minutes twice a day, and you can build it up to, say, 15 minutes and then 20 minutes, and then potentially you'd get 30 minutes over a day. I try to encourage people to think about getting 30 minutes of exercise 3 to 5 times per week as a minimum. And as I say, don't be put off by that time. You can do it in divided sessions. We do have the Live Stronger resource here in New Zealand, livestronger.org.nz. And it's got lots of information up on there, but it specifically also gives you access to group classes that are subsidised, that's run through ACC. So that can be quite cost effective for people. So they can just click on, you know, I'm over 65 and I want to have a group exercise class. And here's where I live, and it will give you all of the classes in the area. Retirement villages, of course, often run classes on site. They're usually just for their residents, and they're often no extra charge for their residents. So once people move into retirement villages, they should definitely have a look at what their retirement village offers and use those. ACC has put out the Nimble app, NYMBL. I don't know if any of your patients have tried that, but I've had a few that have tried it. So for people who are tech savvy and like the idea of using an app, that's will no doubt be further developed. There's actually quite a lot of evidence that exercise is good for us, both mentally and physically. And if you go through Cochrane database, you'll find all sorts of evidence. So for example, there's gold level evidence that supervised aerobic exercise training has beneficial effects on your physical capacity, as well as fibromyalgia symptoms. So there's, you know, growing evidence that exercise will help, for example, with pain and pain management, which I think is a really important for a lot of our patients who are getting, you know, chronic OA type pain. Exercise, of course, we know can be helpful for mood disorders. And there has been some RCTs actually showing that land-based, it's as opposed to water-based, therapeutic exercise programs can reduce pain and improve physical function among people with symptomatic hip OA. So I think people with osteoarthritis can sort of get into that negative cycle of my back sore, my knees sore, my hips sore. It actually makes it harder to move because walking, you know, they might think, well, that's painful. And I think patients often think that exercise will further damage the joint as well and further exacerbate the pain. But I think we sort of need to help patients understand that, you know, the arthritis is already there, and that they're unlikely to significantly aggravate those joints. With gentle walking, we're not talking about running marathons. And of course, they could try water-based activities if they were particularly worried about stress on the joints. I mean, definitely physiotherapy developed strength and balance programs is good for falls prevention and bone health. And yeah, I think all around, you know, for mood and cognition, moving is always good.
Yeah, thanks, Helen. I wonder if we can touch on something that is often overlooked in the golden years, and that is sexual health and activity. So I wonder if you could provide some insights to your approach when discussing this topic with older adults. And I suppose some essential elements that I think about often are sexually transmitted infection, perhaps privacy, analgesia, consent, all those sorts of things, and especially if there's cognitive impairment. So what is it that we need to talk to our patients about with regards to sexual activity in the golden years?
Yeah, it's a really good one to think about, isn't it, Louise? Because it's not a topic that's covered well by a lot of people. In fact, I think it's actually not acknowledged. So therefore, it's not acknowledged. It's not going to be discussed. I think GPs and somebody like me, who's not just a geriatrician, I'm a general physician as well, perhaps finds a little bit easier, a little bit more open to discussing these topics because we discuss them with younger people, right? So at least it is something that we are discussing on a semi-regular basis, and therefore we're able to translate those skills because it's just the same discussion, as you say, with some subtleties for older people. So I think it is, first of all, important to acknowledge that patients can and do have sex in various forms at any age. So we can never assume that we're seeing a patient that isn't having sex, right? I must admit, Louise, I don't necessarily ask about it routinely with every patient, but there's probably a lot of things that I don't ask routinely to every patient, and sex would be one of them, that is true. And certainly in the inpatient setting, I mean, I still look after patients in four-bedded rooms. So, you know, as you say, privacy is really important. It's a little bit different in a clinic, isn't it? Although that is a different issue I'll mention in a second. And often in hospital, patients are quite unwell, so it's really not an appropriate time or place necessarily, depending on the clinical context. So I suspect that's partly why it doesn't get talked about or thought about as much in an inpatient setting. In clinics, interestingly, the issue I usually have is that they usually come with someone and it's not necessarily their spouse. I mean, it could be their sister or their brother or their children. And of course, you do need to protect their privacy and you do need to be sensitive, particularly if there are children or grandchildren with them, because the older person is entitled to privacy. But again, we can translate our skills when seeing younger people like adolescents. So it's normal for us to say to an adolescent, you know, that I would normally see you and have some time alone with you without your mum, dad, or whoever's with you. So there's no reason we can't do that for older people. And there might be a lot of things that older people may not want to say in front of their children or grandchildren that isn't related to sex. So it is quite good to offer a person that chance to have some time alone with you. And as I say, there's various reasons I might want time alone with them, talking about cognition, anxiety, making sure they're safe for any reasons physically. And of course, that's a chance then that you could bring up the issue of sex if they've got someone else with them at the appointment. It is really important that we consider testing of STIs when clinically appropriate in older people. I've certainly had some funny looks from students and RMOs and MDT colleagues when this comes up, but I remind them that yes, older people can and do have sex and therefore get STIs and need appropriate treatment for them. And with anything in a clinical context, they're relying on us, right? And not many older people are going to say to us, I think I've got a sexually transmitted disease. They are relying on us to bring that up, to consider it, and then to test and treat appropriately as you would. I've come across some particularly curly issues with regards to consent when it comes to cognition. And I think that's a really important one, but gosh, it's a really difficult one. I was peripherally involved with a situation where there was a married couple who lived in a retirement village. So due to their care needs, they were actually not in the same room. They lived in sort of different areas or different wings, for want of a better way of saying it. But of course, they'd often visit each other. Because of mobility, it tended to be the husband would visit the wife and he would close the door. But the staff started to notice that she was often quite distressed after he left, and that she actually was starting to indicate that she was in some pain afterwards. And she was cognitively impaired with an established diagnosis of dementia. So it did take the staff a little while to click or to realise if there was something else going on. Because, of course, I think health professionals don't always think about sex in older people. And they sort of thought, well, maybe they're having sex. But given her mental state and the fact that she's distressed and, you know, and indicating some pain, you know, is this consensual? And it was a very difficult situation. Difficult discussion when they did try and broach it with the husband. He didn't see the problem. He was having sex with his wife. What's the problem? And indeed, that was the case. So the staff were correct there. You know, hard to know, do you involve the children in that situation? Because again, it's a privacy issue. And they found it really difficult to tease out that issue where the boundaries blur. I was only peripherally involved, but I think in the end, the decision was that obviously he was free to visit his wife, but given the distress and the pain that she was indicating, that he was asked to keep the door open, and the staff saw a marked decrease in her distress as a result. And it's difficult. You don't want to stop people having sex. That's not the point. But I think they did the right thing in this context. This older woman perhaps, you know, wasn't enjoying the experience, and therefore they had a duty of care to protect her. So it is a very difficult area. It's absolutely something that you need to think about. I have tested for and found STIs in older people. If you've got an older person who's having urinary symptoms, lower pelvic pain, or you know, sterile pyuria, yep, you do need to think about STIs. So do not let that one fall off your radar.
Remaining cognitively connected, Helen, is one of those things that we know is important. Why is it so crucial for the well-being of older people to remain connected?
I think it ultimately comes down to our state as humans. I mean, humans are inherently social beings. Even introverts still want to have social interaction, less of it perhaps, with a less number of people, but they still do strive. Yeah, human interaction. And we know that being socially isolated leads to poorer outcomes physically. It's associated with frailty, as well as mental health, and worse cognitive outcomes. We know that socioeconomic deprivation specifically is positively correlated with loneliness. Carer stress, of course, is negatively correlated with socioeconomic status. Interestingly, people who live rurally are less lonely than urban dwellers. But we know that loneliness is a really prevalent issue among older adults. And so it is something that we need to be mindful of. So we need to encourage people to remain socially connected in whatever way works for them. So for some people, that really is just keeping their social circle still quite small. So it might just remain among family and a couple of close friends. Whereas some people might seek out a wider, more varied, and more often, you know, interactions. So they might want to, you know, join walking groups and join coffee groups and have a wider network. And that's fine because we're all different as human. But I think people need something, don't they?
So I was just thinking about loneliness, Helen, and often patients move to retirement villages and they report loneliness and they think that they're going to be less lonely moving into this type of living situation. But is this actually the case?
So that's a really interesting point, because often people who move into retirement villages are lonely to start with, and that's one of the reasons they move in there, right? So Jameson et al., he's a geriatrician who's also an Interi fellow, and he did some really amazing research using Interi data, and it was published back in 2017. So it's a little bit old now, but I still think has some really great learnings. And there has been some work done on loneliness over COVID, but I'm not aware that's been published yet. People over the age of 65 who report feeling lonely, almost a third more likely to enter aged residential care. So that's an interesting reflection, I think, in itself. Once they're in care, actually nearly 40% of people feel lonely, sometimes, often, or always, which is perhaps higher than we might expect. And the factors that are associated within this Interi study of loneliness include things like being widowed, being divorced, separated, or never married, feeling that they have a poor to fear, so quite a low quality of life. If they expected to gain more social connections by moving to retirement village, you know, that might not have turned out for them, so they often feel more lonely. And if they've got any risk factors for depression as well. So there are a considerable portion of people living in these retirement villages who do report feelings of loneliness, and you can kind of see perhaps those who don't have a partner, those who are at risk of depression, those with a decreased quality of life are at higher risk for that. So it's hard, isn't it? I think there's a lot of ways that we can help to maximise people's ability to interact and feel safe to get out and interact with the world, because that's often something I think that they see barriers. Mobility, of course, is vital to be able to get out and access the world. If you're in a retirement village, I mean, I've certainly had patients say to me that where their particular unit is, it's actually a really long way, you know, to reception or to where the exercise group is held or whatever. They want to go to the group, but they can't actually make the distance. Or come winter and it's cold and wet, then they're not able to make that walk to get to there. I've heard of people living in retirement villages where there's sort of hills in between places. So they're saying, well, I can't walk up that hill anymore to get to the exercise group, which is sort of a shame, isn't it? If you're not in a retirement village, then, of course, you're stuck with some sort of transportation issue to get to things. I mean, we're lucky in Auckland because we have free public transport off peak for super gold card holders. And if you're not driving, you can have a total mobility scheme to get you half price taxis and things like that. I mean, there are a number of organisations that, whether you're in a retirement village or not, can help patients facilitate community involvement. So Dementia Auckland, I think, is an extraordinary organisation. They do a lot of support groups, and some of those are walking groups, and they can be for people with dementia or people who support the person with dementia. So I think it's really important that all of us are aware of what community supports are out there to try and stave off this loneliness. And there were, of course, accredited visitor services prior to COVID. I think some of those are back up and running now, which is really great. I think the biggest thing that I hear from patients when it comes to loneliness is that they don't see enough of their family, that their family are too busy, they have so much on, and they don't feel that they can share that with their family even. You know, they feel that they don't want to be a burden, they don't want to make their family come and visit them, but they would love to have more visits, right? People say all sorts of things to us, don't they, in a consultation room that they perhaps wouldn't say outside. We all have responsibility to prioritise time with older relatives, to make it an important non-negotiable part of our lives. And by doing that, we're going to start role modelling that for our peers and our children. And when we talk to, you know, friends and colleagues, what do you do for the weekend? Hey, I went and saw my grandma at her retirement village. And even though she doesn't, you know, say my name anymore, she always lights up when I see her and I know that she loves my visit. You know, do you have any older people that you go and visit regularly? And I think if we're seeing that younger generation, so, you know, people like yourself as a GP and myself as a general physician, perhaps just saying when they say, oh, you know, my parents are in care, oh yeah, and how often do you get to see them and how do you find that experience? Because it can be really upsetting. I can kind of understand why some people are reluctant. You know, going into rest homes and retirement villages isn't always the nicest, it shows you, you know, disability and comorbidity, and it sort of makes you confront your own mortality in some ways, doesn't it? So people can kind of shy away from it. But I think we do need to, yeah, bring that to the forefront and sort of bring a collective responsibility to kind of help stave off the loneliness that we see in the older generation. I saw a really interesting documentary that I'm going to try and watch from Australia, where they were talking about how odd, really, how artificial things like retirement villages are, because it's only one generation. And so they took a bunch of teenagers and put them into a retirement village for a few weeks and see what happened. And so I think that's a really interesting social experiment and shows us that we need to start thinking outside the box, right? How we can support lonely older people and accept a society that it's up to all of us to help ensure that they have enough social interaction.
Helen, I was thinking as you were talking about not just loneliness, but the loss of sense of worth. And that seems to be something that's particularly common as our patients retire. So I wonder how you address this with your patients and what suggestions you may have in this regard.
Yeah, that's a really interesting one, isn't it? And I think we also have to remember the cultural overplay on that one, because I think it tends to be more Pākehā who feel the loss of sense of worth more than some other cultures. At least that's what I've observed. And I think it partly explains why people are working for longer, not just because they need money or they want some cognitive stimulation. It's about how we define our sense of self-worth as well as in our cultural society. And therefore, if you lose that aspect of you, then yeah, you feel like you've lost some of your worth. And so we do need to recognise and understand as humans that we have multiple ways of being worthy or being valued. And so I think some of that's about a cultural shift, because I really think that older people are probably the most underutilised resource in the country. They have so much experience and it's so vital for our younger generation. When you can have a good relationship intergenerationally, that's really important to many older people. The people who do better and tend to not sort of lose their sense of self-worth, they keep up hobbies as much as possible. And that's just, you know, taking something that you love and enjoy and continuing it as you age and perhaps adapting to it as you age as well. And I think that's probably why a lot of people turn to those low-impact activities such as golf and bowls. And I think the benefit also of having older people involved at a community level with organisations like that, they might have a little bit more time and a little bit more inclination to support community endeavours. So they might, you know, then go on the golf club committee or the bowls club committee, and that actually runs and keeps those organisations ticking over. And of course, you might therefore find that you've got an accountant on the group and you know, a marketer on the group and all those things. So their skills could really be put to use in that way, and that would give a sense of worth. I personally would love to see more old people going to schools. I think if we could get older people into schools, some schools do it, but if we could sort of introduce things like that culturally, where older people go into schools doing reading to kids, right? Talking to them, teaching them about what they've learned throughout their life, travel experiences that they've had, teaching them about passions such as gardening. I mean, we're really focusing more and more on sustainability, aren't we? And if we can help to grow those sorts of passions in younger people, I think that would be, yeah, really awesome. The preschool that my kids went to a couple of times a year, at least, would go to one of the local aged care facilities and would put on a little song show, you know, dance. So they did a Christmas one, I think, and an Easter one. But the people who lived there just loved it, you know, to have visitors and young, youthful visitors. They didn't mind the noise. They thought it was fabulous. I think we also have to remember that old people are not in prison. They can go out. So even if they're in residential care, they can get into a car. They could go for a drive and have a coffee, right? I think that once people move into an aged care facility, they and we, those of us that don't live in them, perhaps sort of forget that aspect. I think that's changing a little bit now because there are more and more people living independently in retirement villages before they enter into that rest home and a private hospital sort of level of care. But I think even when you're at that level of care, you can still absolutely get out and see what's outside the gate, so to speak. I love hearing about schools, for example, providing outreach, so primary or secondary schools that do things like take their choirs or the orchestras in to provide entertainment and cultural experience for the residents, which is awesome. I've noticed there's a huge variety, of course, in aged residential care, so some have amazing resources. I've gone to some where they've got proper library and amazing amounts of puzzles and things like this, which is something, of course, the resources they can use for themselves, but it also means that they could say to a niece, nephew or grandchild, it's a rainy day, come over and do a puzzle with me. Or when we, you know, are at home and want them to do those things ourselves, can say, actually, why don't we just go to this puzzle with Nana, you know? Some facilities have, you know, lots of activities and they have vans and you can go out and do trips and all those sorts of things. They also have lots of groups at some facilities. Things like knitting and quilt making. I'm going to be really interested to see how those sorts of things change over time, potentially. I actually think it might be more the men that need more, you know, workshops or something more specific for men. That's what I tend to notice when I go to these places, that perhaps they're a little bit more catering for women. Does that make sense? And I think if then they can have access to some of these activities, either for themselves and or teaching younger generations, that then they would gain a sense of self-worth. But I do feel strongly that as a society, and again, you know, in our generation, that it's up to us as well to show older generation that they absolutely still have worth and value, and that we would like to tap into that, so to speak.
And I think actually the other thing that I really notice with my patients, and I think you're quite right, it's usually the men, is they just need positive reinforcement and someone telling them they're doing really well. You know, they've often come from very high-powered jobs or been in the work environment where they're constantly getting feedback that is positive, and that sort of stops when they stop work. So having that sense of self and sense of self-worth does need to be nurtured and fostered. And I think we can do that as clinicians, but I think as a community, we really need to support our older people to thrive. So yeah, really nice points there. Just finishing off today, I wonder if we can just touch on cognitive stimulation and why that is so important. You've mentioned some activities that happen in rest homes, like puzzles and Sudoku and what have you, but what sort of things do you think are important and have actually been shown in the evidence to keep our older people cognitively stimulated and thriving?
Cognitive stimulation therapy is definitely proven to help with staving off a dementia and cognitive decline. The issue is, at least in this country, there is very limited access to that as a therapy group, right? You know, you can't necessarily go and do it with a group of people at the moment. So people are often just left to their own devices. But I do think that there's a plethora of options nowadays, and even just pointing those out are really useful. We know that even socially connecting is cognitively stimulating. So that is one way of getting your cognitive stimulation. And we also know that physical activity as well is. So both social and physical activity will also help your cognitive functions. That's good. But in terms of true cognitive stimulation, you want to be thinking about a good old paper options for the current generation, although when our generation comes through, it might be more app-based, shall we say. So, you know, we're really talking about things like crosswords, word searches, Sudoku, those sorts of things. You can buy puzzle books. You can get them from the Herald. I've met plenty of people who tell me they're still doing the paper crossword every day. There's tons of online games now. So, you know, you probably know yourself the New York Times Wordle. There's the Waffle. There's ones where you can guess what country it is. There's just so many options. And I think the bonus of the online versions is that in some ways it's actually better if you're failing with arthritic hands, perhaps, that you can actually still just tap and move things around. But also, you can actually have a social aspect to that. You know, I've certainly heard of people who do something like the Wordle with their family at night. So they might all jump onto a, you know, WhatsApp voice or video phone call and say, all right, yep, we're going to try and solve the Wordle. Let's see who does it quicker, or let's have a talk and try and help each other to solve them. So I think those online versions provide that sort of possibility, which is really cool. Well, even if they don't get to do it together, they could still, you know, message or call their family and say, oh, I did the Wordle today. Have you done it yet? What did you get? How many attempts did you do? You know, it gives you a way to connect with people, which I think is really cool. There are just so many apps out there which you can use. One that I've been looking at recently is Elevate app. A lot of those sort of apps too, if you were not wanting to pay for them. Elevate, for example, without a subscription, you can do 3 activities per day. And to be honest, that might be enough for some people, right? Just to do 3 activities per day. I think we shouldn't ignore things like listening to music. We know that music really stimulates our brain, as does podcasts, listening to audiobooks, if the eyesight's failing and they're not able to read books so easily, watching documentaries. I mean, what we know is that doing anything is better than nothing. Ideally, you do something every day that stimulates your brain, and ideally, you vary what you do. So if all you do is the New York Times crossword, well, I'm very impressed, but you do need to be doing something different. So you want to mix it up a bit. And I think that, you know, that's very clear through research that our brain usually likes a bit of variety and a bit of a challenge. So if you only do word searches, you'll get better at word searches, sure. But we want a more broader uptake in cognitive stimulation. So I think, you know, thinking outside the box, working with whatever limitations the patient has in terms of failing hearing, eyesight, or hand dexterity is really important as well. Trying to introduce whatever social aspect you can. I mean, that's why things like bingo and things can be quite popular, because it's a social activity as well as keeping your mind very focused and listening for your particular numbers or whatever it is. And I think also doing these activities intergenerational is a really good idea. And so that is a way that children or grandchildren can interact with an older person. Is, oh, hey, I found this cool thing online. It's called the Wordle. You know, you've got to put in these letters and try to figure out what this word is. Can I show you what I did last night and what the word was? And hey, do you want to have a go with it with me? You know, that's a pretty simple, easy way of trying to make a connection. And they might not be into the Wordle. Cool. So try something else the next time you go and visit them and see what they think about it. And all of that's going to help stimulate and hopefully keep the brain ticking over as much as we can.
Helen, to finish up today, your take-home messages for our listeners, please.
The main thing is really to prioritise remaining socially connected, physically active, and keep your brain active with some cognitive engagement. I think that we do need to think about, you know, culturally, right from ourselves through to our own family, through to our own friends, how can we actively engage with the older generation? And how can we help them to remain socially, physically, and cognitively active? And how is that going to look for us when we get there? And so what would we like to be in place in including older people in our plans and our lives, making sure that sex and sexual health is on the list of things that we ask our patients about and need to get comfortable with asking older people about that. All of this plays into also combating loneliness, that we want to make sure that we value our older people, help them to have a sense of worth in retirement through ultimately remaining socially, physically and cognitively active.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time today. It's been a really thought-provoking discussion and some great take-home messages for us to both use professionally in our families and with our communities. If you're a New Zealand GP and would like to claim CPD points for listening to this podcast, our podcasts are eligible, so please log them. You'll also find a list of resources on our website, goodfellowunit.org. Thanks for joining us today.